It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter, VOA's forum for ideas and opinions in a dynamic world. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. We'll meet today's guests in just a short moment. Today on Encounter, how promoting democracy is being propagandized as, believe it or not, a bad idea. Now, let's back up just a moment. There's a story that we're seeing playing out currently in the Russian-Ukraine standoff that, frankly, we've seen before. Russian authorities, and let's be accurate and call some of them propagandists, are busy selling a story that the West and the United States are responsible for stirring up trouble in Ukraine. How? Well, one of the ways, they say, is through the use of democracy proponents. These are non-governmental organizations like National Endowment for Democracy or Freedom House. These groups work to build the institutions of civil society and support activists all over the world working for greater liberties and more of a voice in their own government. Do-gooder stuff, basically. But according to the Russian government, such groups are little more than shadow organizations used by the West, maybe even the CIA, to train local youth in the art of rebellion, all with an eye to overthrowing, quote, unfriendly governments. If only for those meddling NGOs, the line goes, all would be well and the population happy. What is the role and the use of democracy promotion? Who supports it? Who opposes it? And does it even work? That's our topic today. Let's meet our guests this half hour. Joining us here in Studio 6, it's a pleasure to welcome David Kramer. Mr. Kramer is president of Freedom House. That's a non-governmental organization based here in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And also joining us by phone from Sarajevo is Miridana, or Maggie Sadovich. She's Western Balkans director with the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. And it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mr. Kramer, let's begin with you. What exactly is the purpose of Freedom House?
Freedom House is the oldest human rights organization in the United States, founded in 1941 to confront several isms, Nazism, fascism, communism at the time, but also a sense of isolationism in the United States, where there was a mood and an atmosphere where Americans thought we didn't have to deal with the threats to freedom and democracy elsewhere. We were walled off from that. And Freedom House argued that threats to freedom and democracy in other places are, in fact, a threat to freedom here in the United States. So Freedom House, over the decades, has been promoting through programming and advocacy and analysis issues of freedom, democracy, human rights, and trying to promote those causes throughout the world.
Do you overthrow governments?
We do not. If only we were anywhere near as powerful as people suspect we are. We try to help empower civil society. And by that, it's simply giving them the training, expertise, advice, and tools to widen their network, to engage in effective advocacy campaigns, to make issues that are relevant to the wider population, to give them a voice in many cases where authoritarian regimes are trying to silence their voice. So those who accuse us of being fronts for the CIA or overthrowing governments, it's just pure nonsense.
Maggie Sadovich, you're on the ground. You're in Sarajevo, but of course you study and research the entire Balkan region. How often do you encounter this storyline, essentially that the West is using these pro-democracy groups to basically stir up trouble and overthrow governments?
I would say that I encounter those kind of rumors quite often, most recently during the civil unrest which took place in Bosnia at the beginning of February. As you probably know, there was quite serious social unrest which resulted in dozens of injured people and some damaged buildings. So although people in Bosnia have been dissatisfied with the local government for quite some time, they were doing nothing for many years. And all of a sudden, we saw these civil unrest, and people began wondering why and how was it possible for all this to happen, and especially in such an organized way, because the riots took place simultaneously in several cities throughout Bosnia. So, yes, of course, very shortly after these events, people began speculating that somebody else must have been involved, probably some Western government, and of course the USA.
I don't expect national populations are credulous, so I wonder, where do you think these stories, this storyline, begins? Is it government forces or government broadcasting, propaganda, what have you, that begins this idea and then the population picks it up? Or is this something more deeply rooted within popular belief?
I would say both. For example, president of Bosnia's smaller administrative entity, Republika Srpska, Milorad Dodik, openly accused Western governments of inciting these unrests and being behind these unrests, and he said their goal was really to overthrow his own government. On the other hand, lots of ordinary people believe the same thing, because, as I said, it's one thing to be unhappy with the government, but it's a completely different issue when you do something about it. And what we saw in Bosnia in February was a concrete action. People took it to the streets. There was a lot of violence. Fortunately, nobody died. But these violent protests finally made the governments do something about people's demands. So I would say that these protests finally provoked change.
Maggie Sadovich with the Institute of War and Peace, reporting online from Sarajevo with us, and David Kramer, president of Freedom House, here in studio. Our topic today, we're taking a look at democracy promotion and those who are opposed to it and the hazards of doing just that. So, Maggie Sadovich, I'm curious, again, you're there. For those who believe this storyline, do you get a sense that it comes from perhaps some historic distrust of the West or some outside force? Does it come from perhaps, I don't know, maybe it's just easier to blame somebody else than to look at your own government and get angry with that? I mean, what are the sort of internal forces that create the environment for this?
I would say it's a combination of all these factors which you have just mentioned. So it is the politicians themselves, because, of course, it's much easier to blame foreign governments for all that is going on rather than to look in the mirror and try and change something and correct some mistakes that they did in the past. Also, regular, ordinary people wonder how was it possible, as I said before, to see these changes all of a sudden. Thirdly, I would say that even the foreign governments are somehow contributing to this belief, that, by the way, they reacted shortly after they had taken place. Actually, the U.S. government, I have to mention the U.S. embassy and their officials here in Bosnia, who are very careful not to condemn the protests themselves, but they only condemned the violence, but they were very careful to say that this is the voice of the people, and the politicians have to hear it. And also, it was the Americans who really felt very frustrated by the situation in Bosnia, which was not going anywhere. I mean, it was a status quo for a long time, and many ordinary people believed that it was actually the Americans who were behind these protests, because that was the only way to ignite necessary changes.
So what you're saying is that people do pay very close attention to what the West and the United States are either saying or what they're not talking about and not saying.
Yes, absolutely. People in Bosnia have very good relations with the USA, and they consider Americans a great friend, particularly Bosniaks or Bosnian Muslims and even Croats. Bosnian Serbs somehow somewhat different. But still, I would say that the United States government is very well respected, and people listen to their reactions very carefully.
We'll let you go in just a quick moment, but David Kramer, I'm curious, are you surprised by anything that you're hearing from Maggie Sadovich here?
No, I think Maggie has got it just right, which is, let me put Bosnia specific aside, because Maggie is there on the ground and knows the situation much better than I could pretend to. But authoritarian regimes refuse to look in the mirror to find blame and responsibility for a deteriorating situation in their country. They also have difficulty believing that their own populations would mobilize against their rule. And so it is all too convenient for them to point the finger at outside forces, at those nefarious Americans or Westerners in general, who, through the prism of promoting democracy, are actually trying to overthrow them. And so it is a fairly common narrative that we see in many different parts of the world with authoritarian regimes who are also confronting technologies that are able to mobilize crowds in a scenario such as Maggie was just describing in Bosnia, mm-hmm. where there are more turnouts at the same time.
And we should mention here, by the way, that we did invite a very prominent critic, an individual who writes against these kinds of organizations like yours, and he refused to appear in a panel. He wanted to appear by himself, and that's just not the way that we play it here. Maggie Sanovich, thank you so very much for your thoughts and for your time and your good work in Sarajevo.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you, Maggie.
Marijana Sanović, Western Balkans Director with the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests, Maggie Sanović, who just left us, and also remaining here in studio, David Kramer, President of Freedom House. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. This week, we're taking a look at the mechanics and the hazards of democracy promotion. Now, one quick reminder, Encounter can be heard online as a podcast as well as on radio. You can find it at voanews.com/encounter. While you're there, why not let us know about what you've heard here today and what you'd like to hear more of? We love hearing from you. The email address is encounter@voanews.com. David Kramer, let's turn to the situation in Ukraine right now. And I want to start off, if I may, with a comment made on this day, the day that we're taping this. President Obama made a fairly major address in Belgium. And he had this to say. He addressed this head on, actually. He said, it wasn't the United States that filled up the Maidan, that's the Maidan Square in Kiev. It was Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. And then he went on to go to speak about Tunisians and Egyptians and whatnot. Why do you think the president of the United States would be addressing what seems to be, again, these rumors, which you would think one could ordinarily easily dispel?
I think it's very important that the president address this head on and is debunking these myths and this propaganda that authoritarian regimes are trying to propagate that suggest this is all because of the West, this is all because of the Americans. It's an insult to Ukrainians and Tunisians and Egyptians and Libyans, you name the country and the populations. These people are turning out because the good news in light of what we're seeing around the world is more people around the world are demanding dignity, freedom, human rights, an end to corruption, transparency, rule of law. And that is a very positive development. The authoritarian regimes are trying to keep up with it and respond to it and, in fact, snuff it out before it develops. And I would argue that's one of the reasons we've seen President Putin move into Crimea to try to send a signal that none of this kind of activity is going to be tolerated in Moscow. That said, it was very impressive that about 10 days or so ago, there were some 50,000 people who turned out in the streets of Moscow to protest Putin's decision to go into Ukraine. Against considerable risks, threats that they face, a situation in Russia is getting worse because Putin is worried that what he saw develop and unfold in Ukraine could in fact happen in his own country.
Does or did Freedom House have operations in Ukraine?
We do programming where we work with organizations in helping journalists to expose matters of corruption and other kinds of things. So we've been doing that now for several years. We don't have an office in Ukraine.
So help me make this a little bit more concrete, I guess, for our listeners. Give us a sense as to the kinds of activities that Freedom House may undertake, either in a nation like Ukraine or a number of the other nations that you operate in. What do you do?
We work in places where there is local interest and demand for our kind of help and support.
So do you have to be invited in? Is that the idea?
We want to find local partners. Partners that want Freedom House or similar kinds of organizations to come in, provide technical assistance, expertise, training, awareness raising, those kinds of things that in many cases, depending on the country, they have no experience with those efforts. And so they need help from outside groups in order to improve their activism, their outreach. And that's what we try to do. We try to help empower civil society groups, whether it's to monitor and report on cases of fraud in elections, mm-hmm. whether it's to raise the plight of oppressed minorities, various groups such as the LGBT community. All of those things we try to help and support, but if there's not local interest in what we have to offer, we won't go there.
So you work with local partners. You'd already mentioned also some work in journalism. Do you work with local groups or train people on the ground in techniques of protest, in techniques of, we don't call it passive resistance anymore, I suppose active resistance, but active nonviolent resistance?
We don't do training on protests. We have worked with some groups that are interested in mobilizing certain segments of the population, but it's not on how to organize protests. There are other organizations that do that. Mm-hmm. There are groups that help with civil disobedience and those kinds of things. Freedom House is not one of them.
How many nations are you active in, would you say?
We have various programming in about 30 countries around the world, and we have field offices in about 13 countries.
And if you were to give us a measure of success, what yardstick would you use?
Measurements are really tricky in this line of work. We produce annual reports, Freedom in the World and Freedom of the Press, in which we rank countries into three categories, free, partly free, and not free, using a pretty sophisticated methodology that asks a number of different questions of countries around the world. So in that sense, we are able to measure how a country is doing. We're not so able to attribute our assistance to civil society groups in that country's development toward a democracy.
Does democracy promotion ever simply not work? Does it just sometimes simply fail to take root in a nation?
This is a long-term investment that requires patience, which many people don't have, in the countries that we're trying to help, as well as on the Hill or in the administration, when there's a demand for rather instant action. So it's in our interest to try to help these groups. And it's also important to keep in mind that these groups look to the U.S. They look to the West, Europeans and Canadians and others. They look to us for help, moral help, financial assistance, political support, solidarity. It means a great deal to them to know that there are people outside of their country, in the United States and elsewhere, mm-hmm. who believe in what they're fighting for and believe in the cause of freedom and democracy.
You know, Maggie Sanovich brought up an interesting point, one I hadn't considered, and I should have, which is that occasionally I imagine that the actions of the United States or the inactions of the United States might actually be unhelpful to the cause of advocating for greater freedom, greater democracy. Does an example come to mind?
We do try to follow, if you will, the Hippocratic Oath of doing no harm. So if having either the presence of a U.S. organization on the ground would be counterproductive, we won't go there. But at the same time, we tried to support groups when indigenously there's no opportunity for them to get either funding or political support. There are cases around the world where, in the absence of outside support, these organizations will go out of business. Mm-hmm. And so our role is to try to help them to adjust to local legislation, to try to change and modify local legislation, working with governments. We don't always take a hostile approach to governments. We try to work with some governments that show an interest and willingness to work with us and try to promote the partnership between civil society and governments, because that tends to be the best way to do this.
Does a good example come to mind?
We've been working in Ethiopia, where we've been trying to reach out to the government. There was legislation that was implemented in Ethiopia cracking down on foreign funding for civil society organizations back in 2009. And we've been in touch with officials as well as civil society on possibilities to make some amendments to that legislation. We recognize that getting rid of or eliminating the legislation isn't in the cards, but we try to make some adjustments to free up some space for civil society.
How dangerous is democracy promotion?
I don't think democracy promotion is dangerous at all. I would say that encouraging grassroots efforts for democratization is in U.S. interests, and it's in the interests of the democratic world, not just the United States. Democratic countries are the ones that tend not to go to war with each other. They tend to share general overall interests, not to say we agree on everything. Think mm-hmm. back to Iraq in 2003, mm-hmm. where some of the best and most reliable U.S. allies, Germany and France, were firmly against the war in Iraq. So it's not to say that we'll always agree, but democratic countries can find a way of disagreeing if there are issues where we don't see eye to eye.
Let me offer a counter, which is the situation we're facing right now. Now, you could say no democracy is perfect. Certainly, we're not standing here wagging the finger. But, you know, the Russian nation, there are democratic elections. There are democratic elections in Ukraine. Now, it just so happens that the legitimately elected president there fled the country, and that created this situation we're in. But those two nations are clearly nominally democratic, and yet they're in, I would say, serious conflict with one another.
I would describe the situation in Russia differently than in Ukraine. Russia, in our rankings, falls into the not free category. And the elections in Russia, I think, have been widely viewed as not free and fair, including the December 2011 parliamentary election, which triggered tens of thousands of people to go out in the streets and protest United Russia's victory, and then protests leading up to President Putin's re-election in May of the following year in 2012. In Ukraine, Ukraine has had a series of elections that have essentially passed the test. I was there in January and February for both rounds of the presidential election, which President Yanukovych won by 3.5% over Yulia Tymoshenko. And that had been the latest in a series of about four or five nationwide elections that were widely viewed as credible. After 2004, when there were efforts for Yanukovych essentially to steal the election, and that triggered the Orange Revolution. Since Yanukovych became the elected president, I would argue he forfeited his legitimacy. One shouldn't think that coming to power through democratic elections endows one with permanent legitimacy. You have to maintain and earn that legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And Yanukovych, I think, through a series of missteps and abuses, forfeited that legitimacy, culminating in his decision to not go along with the partnership agreement with the European Union, but then in particular his use of force against peaceful protesters. That was the final straw. And then he left. Mm-hmm. He fled. And then
the vacuum,
but also the parliament that his party used to control voted him out. Everyone had had enough of him by that point on February 22nd.
You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking back when we introduced this topic, we said essentially, you know, look, this is a story we've heard before. I'm thinking back to Egypt during the so-called Arab Spring. Now, I know this wasn't Freedom House. This wasn't an organization of yours. But there were two organizations affiliated with the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute. Mm-hmm. Both had activists there. Both were working on democracy promotion type issues. And the government there not only did not look well on those activities, but actually arrested the people who were engaged in them, convicted them, eventually let them go. But that right there strikes me as a significant danger.
We actually did get caught up in this.
Oh, you did?
We were one of the five organizations, along with NDI-IRI that you mentioned, the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, and the International Center for Journalists. Our office was raided on December 29, 2011, by heavily armed Egyptian forces. Seven of my staff were put on trial. They were all convicted. They received varying sentences. Fortunately, none of them has actually been in jail, but it was a totally trumped-up, politically motivated trial against Western organizations that were trying to help Egyptians, and that's what it really boils down to.
Did that have a chilling effect?
There's no doubt. We were forced to close, as were the other organizations, and the other kinds of regimes around the world were very closely following what happened in Egypt and were seeing what the Egyptian authorities could get away with and thinking what they could get away with. The same thing happened, by the way, when the Putin regime kicked out the U.S. Agency for International Development in September 2012. Other countries around the world were watching what the U.S. reaction was going to be to the decision by Putin to expel USAID. And we have seen this replicated in some places, particularly in Latin America, where USAID mm-hmm. was kicked out. And so it's really important when these kinds of issues arise for the United States government, as well as other Western governments, democratic nations, frankly, to stand up and say, this is not acceptable.
Now, I'd mentioned earlier that we made legitimate efforts to bring on a critic. Mm-hmm. He just did not like the terms of how we engage in discussion here. But let me ask you the question. If I'm thinking to Egypt, if I'm thinking about Ukraine, if I'm thinking about Venezuela, for example, mm-hmm. is there some validity to individuals' or locals' concerns that, you know what, maybe some of the trouble, maybe some of our problems are being stirred up by Western activists who are coming into our country and, you know, stirring the pot?
Let me answer it two ways. One, as I mentioned earlier, we set up an office in Egypt and we're working with Egyptian organizations because those organizations wanted us to be there. We didn't insert ourselves where we were unwelcome by Egyptian civil society. We were there because they wanted Freedom House to be present. They wanted the other organizations to be present as well. But at the same time, it's not the countries of just the leaders. The leaders take this sense that it's their country. it's actually the country of all Egyptians, all Ukrainians. And so when the Yanukovyches or the Mubaraks or the Morsis, you name it, take this approach, well, you're not welcome as far as we're concerned. Well, let's ask what the populations want. Most of the populations won't even know who we are. But for civil society, they do want and need help that we can provide. Sometimes it comes in different forms. Sometimes it's not so public. It's private because of the risks that are entailed in doing this kind of work. So I really want to pay tribute to Ukrainians who turned out in the streets in terrible weather against significant risks, who are demanding dignity and rule of law and transparency and ties with Europe, not at the expense of Russia, but at the same time together with Russia. Egyptians and Tunisians, you know, it's a long list. We're seeing it now, as you mentioned, in Venezuela. With Venezuelans, and sadly, the death toll is mounting. So these people turn out against tremendous risks and threats that they face, but they believe in a cause that I think the United States should, and in some cases does, identify with.
David Kramer, we're nearly out of time. How often do you get discouraged?
In this line of work, you have to wake up every day looking forward to going and helping people. But our Freedom in the World survey has registered 8 years of decline in freedom, where there have been more declines among countries than gains. That said, there are more countries that are, if you will, in play. In the Arab world, there was no movement for decades. And then starting in late 2010, early 2011, we saw movements in the Arab world that we had never seen before. So I think that inspires hope for all the troubles and difficulties that these countries face. The fact that there is, if you will, an awakening, I think is a very inspiring development.
Thanks so much for joining us in studio today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank all our guests joining us today. David Kramer here in Studio 6. He's president of Freedom House. That's a non-governmental organization based in Washington, D.C. Also, thanks to Maggie Sadovich, who joined us earlier. She's the Balkan director for the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Encounter was produced in Washington. Many thanks to Anya Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Brian Marcoulier. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. We hope you'll be with us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.